Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. Welcome back to the show.
It's always great to be on your show.
Hilliard, Ontario Premier Doug Ford has just said that parts of the Toronto Greenbelt now will not be open to urban development and will remain mostly wildlife preserves. Kind of a political disaster for him. Two cabinet ministers resigned over it after the ethics commissioner found out that they didn't use a free and open process to bid on these new lands.
Yeah, the other aspect of that is, because I don't know the political implications, although I did note that the ethics commissioner said that he would not be charged, the premier would not be charged, but the other thing that, having lived in Alberta and watched Edmonton and Calgary, there's never been any problem in spreading out further and further into the hinterland to build new developments of housing, and I think that's part of the reason why housing prices are lower. They're not particularly low in Alberta, but they're lower, much lower than they are in around Toronto. So that land that was going to come out of the buffer zone will mean that less housing will get built. But, you know, I'm not entirely convinced that it's a shortage. I know that everybody is talking about a shortage of housing and we need more housing, but it's not so much a shortage of overall housing, because the percentage of money that's been going into housing in Canada is much higher than it has been in the U.S., and that's for at least a decade, if not longer. And it's the type of housing that's being built. They're building expensive high-rise condos rather than affordable housing, and that's the problem. And I'm not quite sure what the solution is, but when you leave it up to the private sector, they want to get the most profit for the per square foot of the land that they're using. And for a long time, that was expensive condos. Now, that seems... There's stories now coming out of Toronto and Vancouver that people that have bought these pre-construction condo contracts 2 or 3 years ago are now finding with the higher interest rates that they can't close on the deal. And that means there's going to be a whole bunch of failures of closure. So there probably will be some condos that will come free as the other people are unable to close, and that might free up some supply. But, you know, 400, 500 square foot condo, that doesn't really help a family that's moving to Canada from a country that has they're used to having several generations living in one house and several kids running around. These 400, 500 square foot condos are just not going to do it. And they were designed to go for investors. And what we really need is housing for families.
Also, a study by McGill found in BC, 17,000 potential rental properties are now short-term rentals, Airbnbs.
Yeah, and that, you know, that whole thing, you got to wonder about how much longer that can last, because people, I don't quite understand the point of traveling like long distances just to stay one or two nights in a spot. I think there's a certain adventure involved. There's certainly a demand for stuff to post on Instagram, I guess. But I don't know how that all that model works. It certainly doesn't help provide housing for families, and that's what we need.
Well, again, Vancouver now is upping the fee to $1,000 a year if you're going to have an Airbnb property. It was I don't know what it was, but I think $100 before is $1,000 a deterrent. When you can rent it out for $300 a night, you've made that back in 3 days.
Yeah, and what's the enforcement on that? I don't know if they collect all that.
I think something like 40% are unregistered.
Yeah, that's the thing. And I know that I was the executor of an estate, and I had to sell a unit in a fourplex in Kitsilano. And there was just four owners in the building. And the other three owners ganged up on me and said, "You can't sell it to somebody who's going to turn it into an Airbnb." And I said, "Well, I can't control who I sell it to. I have to sell it as the executor. I have to get the best possible price. And there's no control over who I sell it to." And anyway, I don't know what happened. The buyer seemed like somebody who was going to live in it and not rent it out on Airbnb, but you never know, right? So I don't know how you control that stuff. You got to have a team of inspectors going around to all these places and inspecting whether they're renting them out night by night or, you know.
Well, you could have a reward system for turning them in because neighbors know what's going on.
Yeah, and those people, I know that those other three people in that building, if it was an illegal Airbnb, they would turn them in a heartbeat because they were really against it. And I can understand that because it would have really disrupted the quality of life in that building. But I think the solutions are more in the purpose-built rental and the elimination of the sales tax. According to the developers, they seem to be saying it's going to make a big difference to people. I think they were already turning away from condos and building more and more purpose-built rentals.
Yeah. The federal government, announced in Canada it's going to remove the goods and services tax on purpose-built buildings for rental.
And I don't know, like in Alberta, there's no sales tax, but I don't know if Ontario and BC, if they've volunteered to match that or not. I haven't heard that they have yet, but it could help. I don't know if it'll bring down the rents because a lot of the buildings that I've seen that have been built as purpose-built rentals are still pretty expensive, you know, in terms of the monthly rental. But I think when the bubble bursts, it'll all sort itself out faster than people expect. I know right now people expect that nothing will change, but the high interest rates that we've got now and they are really starting to bite into what people can afford. It's taken much longer than I would have thought, but I think it is starting to have some impact on pricing, and and downward prices. It isn't a positive for the older boomers that own the properties already, but for the younger people, it'll be a really positive thing. At 7 or 8% mortgage rate, the amount of mortgage that the average person can handle is probably in the $200,000 to $300,000 range. And if that's what they can afford to borrow, then prices will have to come down to that range because that's where most of the people that buy housing, they're using borrowed money. They don't show up with cash. they have to go to the bank or another mortgage provider and get a mortgage. And they might be able to get a little down payment from mom and dad, the bank of mom and dad, but they still need to have that mortgage.
Yeah. And how do you save up for a down payment when you're paying over $3,000 a month for a one bedroom in Vancouver?
Yeah, I don't know how people can do that. I honestly don't. And they might have a floor of a house in way out in the stick somewhere for $2,600 a month or something like that, but with a neighbor above you and a neighbor below you, and it's quite the situation. And the other possibility is people could just move away from these high rent areas, but there aren't that many places to move to. And it has to be a job wherever you're moving to. There has to be a job, right?
Yeah, and when you said, how do you know what somebody's going to do with an apartment block when you sell it? It's much like the Harley Davidson dealers I've talked to in Vancouver. When they sell that motorbike, it's perfectly legal when it comes to the sound that it produces. But I notice they also sell the kits that can take that muffler off.
Speaking of mufflers on motorbikes, I asked a friend of mine who has a Harley Davidson, and he just got back from a long trip with his buddies going down into the U.S. And I said, I think the electric version is called Livewire or something like that. And I said, "Has anybody buy those electric bikes?" He said, "Oh no." He said, "You can't ride those things. They're too dangerous." And I said, "What do you mean? They're so fast. They're so fast. People are going to get hurt." I said, "Well, isn't that the whole point of having fun, is to get a really fast bike?" But he didn't. He's a traditionalist, of course. He'll never get an electric bike. But they are a lot faster than the old gasoline powered.
The hogs.
That's for sure.
The hogs. Do they make them deliberately to leak oil? Is that a sign? Because I don't know. I don't think I've ever seen a Harley that didn't leak oil.
Well, they certainly have to make that sound, or else you can't sell them. That's for sure.
Now the Bank of Canada has paused on hiking interest rates. The U.S. Fed paused on hiking rates. The Bank of England paused as well, I think. Does that mean that this is the end of rising rates and they're going to pause now? Or will they just squeeze one more in just to say we're still trying to fight inflation?
Great question. The Federal Reserve on Wednesday this week said that they were going to pause. They call it a hawkish hold is the term. They didn't call it that, but the pundits are calling it that. And the reason that it was hawkish was that they paused, but they said we'll probably have to raise rates a couple of more times. Yeah, but the big thing that really shook the market, so the market dropped on Wednesday after the announcement, and on Thursday it dropped again all day, and the markets are closing at the low of the day on Thursday. So the reason that negative reaction was so strong is that they said we might not be able to cut rates until 2026. So they were expecting the market was expecting several rate cuts in 2024, and now the expectation is they might not be cutting for a couple of years at least. And that, so it isn't that rates have to go a lot higher. In fact, they don't have to go higher at all. It's the idea that people are going to have to learn how to live with the current rates, which are in the U.S., the Fed funds rate is around 5.25 to 5.5. It's a range. And that means that mortgage rates are 7%. Long-term bonds rates are 4.5%. It's a whole new era. It's actually not new in the sense that if you go back prior to 2010, it was normal back then. You know, the average mortgage rate up until 2007 was 9% for three decades. It's only after the global financial crisis that we got all these new rates. If we're going back to those previous rates, prior to the GFC rates, we're going to be living with these rates for a long time. And the problem is, how many people, with the amount of debt that is out there in the system that was not there before, the debt was not there before 2010, now that debt is all there, both on the government side and on the private sector side, how will people be able to live with that? And nobody knows yet. I mean, so far, people have not really changed their habits, as far as I can tell. Consumer spending is still pretty strong. But if they keep rates at these levels, a lot of people are going to have to make some adjustments.
Well, my local pub that shows NFL games, it was empty last Sunday. I was the only person who showed up wearing a Seahawks jersey to watch the Hawks play. And
maybe they
the place
just don't
was
like
empty.
The Hawks. Is that possible? They just don't what? Like the
don't
Hawks
like the Seahawks them. In Vancouver.
Ten percent
of the Seahawks season ticket holders are from Vancouver.
Okay, so it wasn't that. Well, you know, I think
it's the prices. The food prices are outrageous. Six pieces of calamari for $20. I could have rented the boat and caught it myself.
And you know, people. Some people do, but the majority of the people don't actually cut back on their spending as they get closer to the point where they need to. They carry on as if nothing is happening until they get a call from the credit card agency or the bank or somebody and say, "Hey, you know what? You're over your limit and there's nothing we can do." And it's a shock to them, right? So that moment, happens when the lender realizes, not the borrower, but the lender realizes that they have to rein it in. And of course, on the lending side, the last 15, 20 years, the lenders have all been, well, let's see how much we can lend. How many people can we find and how big a credit limit can we give them? And if they go back to an era where, where they start to be more careful as to who they lend to, because they realize that some of the people won't be able to pay the money back. That's a huge change. It's a 180-degree change. And there's actually the term Minsky moment applies to the situation where the lenders realize that the people can't repay the debts that they've already got, much less give them any more money. And this, there's some signs. So three of the major, the five big banks in Canada, three of them have a significant number of people, 20-25% of all the mortgage holders, that are not paying even the interest on. They're not paying back any of the principal on their mortgage, and their monthly payments are not even high enough to pay all the interest on their debts. So that's the classic definition of when the Minsky moment happens, is when the lender realizes that these people won't be able to repay their debts. And then it's a completely different relationship between the borrower and lender. It's no longer a sales job. It's a how nasty and mean can the lender be? And we haven't seen that for probably 35, 40 years, I guess. I would have to go back into the 80s when the last time they did that.
What's their solution, Ben? It's not massive foreclosures, because banks tell you they don't want to be in the real estate business. It's to extend the mortgage, the amortization period, to what, 30, 40 years now, 45?
It's to infinity now, yeah. So what they do is they in Alberta, they actually, they had a crisis in 2014, 2015, when there was that oil, when oil prices went way down. And the government-owned bank called the Alberta Treasury Branch just actually took out billboards. Yeah. And the billboard said something like, "We've got your back, Alberta." In other words, we'll help you get through this. And this has been the trend for the last probably 20 years. Any kind of a serious setback, the banks will work with people to say, okay, we'll restructure your loans. We'll make some differences. We'll manage it. But we've never been in the situation up until now where people couldn't even pay the interest on their debts. So that is a whole new situation. And the problem with this is, if the lenders are too accommodating, but the borrower realizes they're never going to be able to pay off the debt, then the borrower starts kind of gaming the system and saying, well, okay, I'm never going to get out of this debt, so I might as well just milk the system for all I can do. And it happens with businesses as well. And that's why when people apply for a type of receivership where they're allowed to stay in control, usually the bank decides that that's not going to work, because the people in charge of the business just, they do all kinds of things like giving preferences to their buddies in terms of who they repay first and stuff. So they have to put a receiver in, and the receiver kicks out the management and takes over the operation of that business, trying to recover as much money as possible for the lender. So we're kind of at that, right on the cusp of that situation where they turn from nice guy to nasty guy. And in the 80s, the last time they really had a big amount of this, they actually sent different people out. They actually got rid of the sales-oriented staff for the lenders. I'm talking about the banks primarily. And they actually brought in more like accounting types who were just, they didn't have any touchy-feely skills at all. They weren't trying to be your friend. They were just trying to get repayment of as much as the loan as they possibly could, or to seize the assets and sell the assets. The problem with that is, and that's where the Minsky moment turns into a debt deflation spiral. You got a whole bunch of lenders that have seized the assets. They start trying to sell them, and who are they going to sell them to? The people don't have any credit anymore to buy stuff with, and the more sophisticated buyers will step back and say, "Hey, we'll wait till this thing shakes out a little bit." Imagine how much condo prices will drop in Vancouver, for example, if a whole bunch of people cannot close on these pre-construction condos that they put a deposit on a couple, 3 years ago. There will be some fire sales. Now, we haven't seen much of that yet. You know, the banks are not, they haven't moved yet. So we'll see whether they do, but that's inevitably where it leads to. And I don't see what's going to, it's hard to imagine. You can always have a surprise. I've had many surprises in the last decade, being involved in this. but it's hard to imagine what the surprise will be that would get us out of this without some serious readjustments. And personally, I think it'll be a good thing because it'll bring prices down. But the other thing is it'll get rid of all the speculation in the system. The speculation, all it did was drive prices higher and made it harder for the people who really wanted the property to live in rather than as something to flip. If we get rid of those people that are the flippers, that'll bring prices back into line where it becomes more affordable, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm also disappointed. We have governments that don't seem to have any focus. And if you ask the Canadian right now, they're worried about being able to afford food, being able to afford a place to live, being able to go to the hospital and somebody actually being there to treat them. And now we have forest fires raging every year. And again, there's no concerted plan to deal with that either. So four major crises facing the nation, and yet Ottawa seems, on their part, determined just to shovel as much of our money overseas as they can for projects that nobody here cares about.
Yeah, well, it's probably too much for them to handle at once. Their record is not being able to fix things very well, and certainly the housing file will probably get even though it when house prices come down and people start getting foreclosed on their properties, no government has ever survived that in democracy, as far as I know.
Yeah,
if anybody has an example of where a government gets reelected after that happens, I'd be interested to hear about it. But as far as I know, there hasn't been a case of a government getting reelected when house prices go down enough to have people thrown out of their homes for failure to pay their mortgage. So they might just have to let that one go and concentrate on some of the other things that are going on. But sometimes governments, they're not very good at solving these things. And even if they were good at solving them, they still might not be able to solve them.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, you're our electric vehicle expert. You've owned a Tesla for how long? Almost a decade now?
Well, not quite. Yeah. 2016 was my first. So I'm coming up to, in March, it'll be 8 years.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, I guess close to a decade. The Tesla model, they did have some electric cars before Tesla brought out the first model in 2012, the Model S. But there were very few. And that was the first one that I noticed that seemed like a exciting car to own. And so I bought it in 2016. My first one was in 2016. Now I'm on my third one. And, my wife has one as well. So we've got two in the family. And, but you know, Canada and the U.S. are way behind. So the leaders are in China and in Europe. And it's gone much faster than people expected. So we're now up to 25 to 30% of all new car sales are electric in both China and Europe. And it depends, you know, there's some of them are hybrids, some of them are all pure electrics, but on average, it's about 30%. In the U.S. and Canada, it's less than 10%. I think the U.S. is up to 8%, which is a huge increase from 2% not that long ago. And Canada's up to 6%. So, and of course, Canada and the U.S. are the most crude oil intensive economies in the world. So, U.S., for example, I know the numbers better for the U.S. U.S., for example, has about 20 million barrels a day of usage out of a world total of 100 million barrels a day. So 20% of all the oil burned. And about half of that, almost half of it, 9 million barrels a day, goes into cars and light trucks. So if electric vehicles take over in a place like the U.S., it'll have a huge impact on the amount of oil that's burned. Now the Europe and China are much smaller impact because they just don't have as many cars per capita, and the cars that they do have are they're much smaller and they don't burn as much fuel. So So, but in total in the world, about 49 million barrels out of the 102 million barrels that are produced each day are used for transport in one form or another. So if half the cars go to, just picking a number, half of the U.S. cars and Canadian cars go to electric by, say, by 2030 or something like that, it'll be, in the U.S. alone, it'll be 4 or 5 million barrels a day, which, you know, is only 5% of the 100 million barrels that we're talking about. But it's a significant number as far as the U.S. goes, because the U.S. is now the biggest oil producer in the world, and they only need to import about 4 or 5 million barrels a day. Most of that comes from Canada. So if half the cars in the U.S. convert to electric, they won't need to import any oil anymore. They won't need to go and meet with the Saudi prince of whatever. They won't need to be nice to Canada anymore because they won't need any oil from anybody. They got enough oil.
Yeah. Now, BC has the highest number of EV sales per capita in North America, with Tesla leading the pack. During the summer months of 2019, the Vancouver Tesla store was delivering upwards of 130 vehicles per day.
Wow.
That's an old stat. You see Teslas here everywhere. I even saw a pink one. Is Elvis in the building?
I don't think pink ones are come from the factory. I think they had to get it re-updated to do that. But yeah. The first one I got, it was the only place in Western Canada that you could have a contact point was in Vancouver. And I didn't go to Vancouver. I just dealt directly with Fremont, California, where the Teslas are made in those days. And they delivered it on one of those big transport trucks that, you know, you see on the highway that have like 10 cars on them. Yeah. They sent one to Edmonton, and I just took delivery of it at the back of a truck in a parking lot. That's how I got it. And then I eventually, I had actually been out to Vancouver to visit out there. That's probably where I checked it out. Maybe I think I did a ride in one before I ordered mine. But now they've got service centers all over. Like, I've got one in Edmonton, one in Calgary. They've got them all over. And
What about charging stations? That's what everybody's worried about. They can't find enough charging places.
Well, people with Teslas generally have not had any trouble because Tesla's always built more charging stations that are actually needed. Now, that might change as Canada starts buying more electric cars, but up until now, it hasn't been a problem. And of course, most people charge in their homes anyway, right? People generally don't go on road trips that often. And so it's much simpler just to charge at home when the car is parked overnight. But the new thing that's happening with charging is that, of course, now all these other car makers like Ford and GM have got electric cars, and their offerings are not that great, but that some of them, like the Ford Lightning, the F-150 electric version, is actually looks like a pretty interesting vehicle. But up until now, they didn't have any good way to charge them, so that was holding people back. But now Tesla's agreed to provide charging for those vehicles now, so that'll have a big impact. And, of course, all the Tesla owners like me are kind of wondering, well, what does that mean? Are we going to have to start to line up behind a Ford F-150 to get our charger? So hopefully they'll build enough new chargers to manage all that new demand for charging. The other thing I've heard from many people say, oh, well, electric cars, you know, the grid won't be able to handle all that demand for all that charging of the electric cars. It's an overblown fear, because it's the same when you charge at home. It's the same circuit that you use for your clothes dryer. So it's like, if everybody in the neighborhood had a Tesla or an electric car of some sort, and even if everybody plugged their car in at the same time, which is never going to happen, but let's assume it did for a minute, it still would be like them all turning on their clothes dryer at the same time. It's not going to be that big a problem. There is a problem within an individual household. If you have two electric cars, most people are getting their main panel upgraded to 200 amps from 100 amps. And that's just because if you had all of the cars plugged in, plus the clothes dryer, plus you turn on the stove all at the same time, you might have a problem. But in general, it's doable. It's possible. And the other thing people don't you know, and this hasn't happened yet. It isn't quite ready yet. But the big new thing would be maybe 5 or 10 years from now that all those batteries in those cars could be used to give electricity to the grid at times when the grid needs help. And so they could become a balancing factor in the managing the electricity demands of the community.
Well, the ads for the Ford F-150 electric lightning pickup feature, hey, in an emergency, you can use the battery in your truck to light your house.
Yeah, and there's enough in, the battery in mine is 100 kilowatt hours. I think it's enough to run your house for 2 or 3 days. It's not. So all of these emergencies that people get, you know, with hurricanes and all that kind of stuff, it's kind of like it's a selling point to think, well, gee, I could hook my vehicle up to my house, and I could if there's a power outage. Usually, power outages only last for a few hours, so there wouldn't be any problem running it off your car. So that's coming. There's no question that that's coming, and that actually, in aggregate, is not going to necessarily be like require a huge new support source of electricity. It just might be that people will get incentives for using their electricity at different times of the day. Certainly solar and automobiles might work really well if the automobile could be getting its charge when the solar, in the middle of the day when the solar is at its peak. Because the problem with solar is, in the middle of the day, it gives too much electricity and then it doesn't give enough electricity, in the evening. So the car could become the transition. You could put the solar energy into the car at 3 PM and then give it back to the house at 6 or 7 PM when it's needed. So there's lots of possibilities there, but the more immediate impact is going to be what happens to the oil market when 30 or 40 or 50% of these cars switch over to electricity. And that is going to be something that will have a big impact, because crude oil is the biggest, financially anyway, the biggest commodity traded in the world. So it's got the most volume of dollars, and there's a lot of people that make a very good living off of trading oil every day. And so they're going to be watching very closely to see how much gets converted to electric.
Of course, crude is used for much more than just powering vehicles. It makes rubber, pharmaceuticals, plastics, things that you're probably not even aware of. So even if we stop burning it to run vehicles, and I'm sure 100 years from now, people will say, you wasted crude oil to run your vehicles? What idiots.
Yeah, well,
because it's so valuable for so many other things.
Yeah, and everybody, especially in Alberta, people say to me, yeah, but crude oil is going to be around for decades, and that's true. But it won't be to the point of 102 million barrels a day. It might be 30, 40, 20, whatever, however many barrels. And the question that nobody's really examined yet is, who's going to be the supplier of that last 20 or 30 million barrels after it comes down from 100? And the Americans, they do 13 million barrels themselves alone, and so they'll be self-sufficient. Canada does 5 or 6 million barrels. We export most of it to the U.S. Russia does 10. Saudis do 10. It'll be interesting to see who is the last man standing, so to speak, when it comes to... And with the lack of investment in new oil production, which is already starting to happen because people are starting to see what's happening with demand. It might become a scarce thing because you always continually have to keep investing to keep the production rate of crude oil up. And if people decide, well, you know, it's not worth it, I don't want to be investing in a declining demand situation, then there might be a bit of a shortage. But you'd have to bet that, and I haven't done the analysis, so this is just a guess, but I'd have to think that the Saudis have a real advantage there because they don't have to do all the extraordinary stuff we have to do, for example, in Canada here with the oil sands. Their fields are much more easy to produce from, and they're much less expensive. I think their lifting costs are $4 or $5 a barrel.
Yeah, I've also read reports that some of their oil fields that they thought had been drained are now filling up again.
Wow. That keeps on giving.
That fossil fuel may not be from fossils, but some kind of natural process within the earth.
Ah, I never heard that before. That's yeah. interesting. Well, I certainly don't think there's going to be a shortage. You know, when I started more than 40 years ago, the talk was peak oil. That was the big thing. Yeah. And they were going to run out of oil. And now it's very clear that we're never going to run out of oil. It's just a question of how much are we going to use? How much will we need? And maybe they'll have someday be a scarcity thing. You know, they still use whale oil from the whales. Yeah, one time that was one of the biggest use of, you know, before crude oil came along. And they still use it, but they only use it for very specific things that very kind of valuable applications. So I don't know if the crude oil business is going to go that way.
Hilliard, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, you know, we talked about the housing bubble a bit in Canada, and but there was a report recently that I wrote about on my weekend note, which people are welcome to subscribe to. It's free. That there's three countries in the world, Korea, Australia, and Canada, that have the most difficult situation when it comes to household debts. Now, China, I started to mention China. China is a little bit different, but they're having their own development crisis, but it's more at the level of the developers and people that built these massive cities that have no people in them. And they built too many of them, and now they've got a crisis at the developer level. But at the household level, the three countries that were identified are Australia, Korea, South Korea, and Canada. And those debts are around 100 to 110% of GDP just at the household level. So that's one thing to watch for, is how do people in those three countries manage the debt levels that they have. It's obviously entirely or almost entirely related to real estate and mortgage debt and that sort of thing.
Hilliard, how can people sign up for your newsletter?
Well, if they go on Twitter or X, as it's called, I guess now they'll see I tweet it on. It comes out on Friday afternoon, and I tweet up, and then they can just link there and then go right to or they can go to the website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com, they can sign up with their name, and then they'll get an email with the weekend note directly if they don't want to get it through social media.
Hilliard, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Bursts, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. You can find him on what used to be called Twitter, now X, at HMacBE. If you have any questions for Hilliard or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. We'll ask that question for you. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at House Street. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of House Street Media Incorporated.